So specifically, it's Jehoiakim got taken over by Nebuchadnezzar. That's where you were.
Yeah, I'm gone.
And he's out.
Nebuchadnezzar tells him, hey, go find some guys. We found some guys. We meet three of the guys, or four of the guys. It might have been five of the guys. I think it's four of the guys.
Four of the guys. Daniel and his three friends.
Daniel and his three friends.
Who are Daniel's three friends?
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
No, but what are their actual names?
Don't ask me that. Don't ask me that.
Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah.
Nice, yeah.
Looking at
good
the
reading.
Paper.
You can read. You didn't even do anything.
Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and they have the whole test thing where they go on a quote-unquote fast.
That's about my roommate doing that.
Yeah.
Not really fast.
They get tested for 10 days to see if they will be allowed to follow their Jewish dietary laws, and of course God provides, and they are. Chapter 2 begins, and this is where we went last week, what happens at the first half of chapter 2.
Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and all the wise men show up, and instead of telling the wise men what the dream was so they can interpret it, he wants them to tell what it is and what it means, and they're saying, they keep hemming and hawing and saying, it can't be done. And he gets mad and says, if you don't find it, you're all going to die.
Yeah.
You're waiting on somebody to take over, so you don't have to answer my question.
Yeah, exactly. Waiting on the times to change. Okay, so he says, you're all going to be killed. He sends Arioch out. Arioch gets to Daniel's house. What does Daniel do?
He says, tell him to wait. Or he goes and meets with the king and says, give us some time. We'll tell you about the dream.
Yeah.
He also tells his friends, hey, we might die, pray.
Yeah. So they do, and then what happens after they pray?
Daniel, it's revealed to Daniel.
Yeah.
The dream, what I mean?
The mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night, and so then Daniel praises the Lord. We see a nice little doxology there. We learned a few theology proper attributes of God through that. And that's where we finished up last week. Therefore, verse 24 of chapter 2 of Daniel. Therefore Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation. That's where we left off. So today, we're going to look at the dream and what it means. And this could be fun. So we'll start with when he heads in to announce it. Excuse me. And just so I know, if you have a variety of Bible translations, let me know what you have. I have ESV. You have NIV, right?
Yes. I have NASB.
You have NASB. You have NET, right? NIV. What do you got there? NIV? Okay.
Multiples. Not Bible Gateway. So I can pull up all of them.
Bible Gateway. Right. If you want to pull up the...
What version?
HCSB. Holman Christian Standard Bible.
Got it.
Since we're in the Aramaic section, you have a little bit more variety among translations, even literal translations, because Aramaic's less well-known and less specific. So, somebody want to read verses 25-30.
So Arioch quickly ushered Daniel into the king's presence, saying to him, I have found a man from the captives of Judah who can make known the interpretation to the king. The king then asked Daniel, whose name was also Belteshazzar.
Nice pronunciation, by the way.
That was unnecessary. Are you able to make known, thank you though, to me the dream that I saw, as well as its interpretation? Daniel replied to the king, the mystery that the king is asking about is such that no wise men, astrologers, magicians, or diviners could possibly disclose. Diviners can possibly disclose it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made it known to to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the times to come. The dream and the visions you had while lying on your bed are as follows. As for you, O king, while you were in your bed, your thoughts turned to future things. The revealer of mysteries has made known to you what will take place. As for me, this mystery was revealed to me not because I possess more wisdom than any other living person, but so that the king may understand the interpretation and comprehend the thoughts of your mind.
All right. So he goes in to Nebuchadnezzar, says, I got it, right? Got the interpretation. Belteshazzar, you pronounced it well. You always put the emphasis on the last syllable in Hebrew and Aramaic, that's why. Most people say Belteshazzar.
I was going to say Belteshazzar.
Yeah.
It's like a cat name.
Yeah.
Come here, Belteshazzar.
Belteshazzar.
Or Shazzy.
I want that to stick in your minds for in 2 or 3 weeks when we get to chapter 4. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known the interpretation to me? So he gives them both names, right? But here, he's still addressing him as Belteshazzar. Right? He's still a Babylonian in thought and action. Nebuchadnezzar worships Bel. Right? You get to chapter 4, and we see him actually change. Chapter 4, verse 8. Just skip ahead. At last Daniel came in before me. This is Nebuchadnezzar speaking in first person. At last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And I told him the dream, saying, oh, Belteshazzar. He finally figures it out, who God really is, and he starts calling him Daniel after that. So, it's a little bit of foreshadowing there. What does Daniel say to him first?
Can you reveal?
Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar says to Daniel, can you make known the interpretation of me? What does Daniel say?
No, I can't, but I know. The one who reveals mystery has revealed it to me.
Yeah. No wise man, enchanter, astrologer can show the king the mystery. But there is a God in heaven. He reveals mysteries. The God who reveals mysteries is... That's what this whole story is about. It's about the God who reveals mysteries. Progressively revealing himself throughout history. You get up to Ephesians. We're going to be all over the Bible today, by the way. So have your fingers at the ready for flipping and fiddling. But Ephesians, who wrote Ephesians?
Paul.
In scholarly circles, most people think, I say most people, crazy liberals think that Paul didn't write it, so they always joke about the author of Ephesians. Paul. Paul's writing.
Paul starts it off?
Yeah.
Paul. Apostle.
Paul's writing, and he's, chapter 3, he starts talking about this mystery that was revealed to him, right? In the same way that Daniel had a mystery revealed to him. For this reason, I, Paul, a prisoner for Christ, on behalf of you Gentiles, assuming that you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace that was given to me for you, how the mystery was made known to me by revelation, as I have written briefly. Talks a little bit about it in verse 6 of chapter 3 of Ephesians. Said, this mystery is that the Gentiles are fellow heirs, members of the same body and partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel. That's the same mystery that Daniel's having revealed here. Just it's not being revealed as much and as clearly. We're going to see, but we got a picture of the ultimate bringing in of the Gentiles in this vision, and we see it more and more throughout Daniel. So that's a common theme in the Bible, as you see. Things in small, in the farther back you go. For example, Genesis 3:15, right? Seed of the woman, seed of the serpent. It's just like this hint at the gospel. And then it gets more and more revealed, more and more well known. So the God who reveals mysteries is kind of the theme of this chapter, this, I mean, all 66 of these books. But verse 28, there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days, is what ESV says. What do the different translations say? Anybody have something different than that?
For the last days?
In the last days?
The days to come.
The days to come.
The last to come.
Times to come.
Latter days.
Latter days. Literally, at the end, is also a fair translation. Last days, days to come, at the end. The question is, what days is he talking about? Which last days? The last days of Nebuchadnezzar, the last days of Babylon, the last days of the BC era, the last days of existence, the earth. What do you think?
Probably Babylon.
Okay, so yeah, Babylon's high on the list, just given the immediate context. What were you were about to point and talk, Nathan?
It's when you just read on the rest to figure that out.
Yeah. I want to get a short list together. What do you think of the leadership?
Clearly already have.
But that's a good answer, too.
Why don't we keep reading and find out?
What does Daniel claim is the reason this mystery was revealed? I don't know why.
Nebuchadnezzar to understand the thoughts of his mind.
Yeah, it was for Nebuchadnezzar's benefit. Okay, but wait a second. Didn't they ask? Oh, okay. That's the same thing. Never mind. I just had a thought, and then I scratched that thought out in my mind. That was why. It was for Nebuchadnezzar's benefit, so that he might understand, right? And as we're going to see in the preceding chapters, progressively he begins to understand a little bit more just who this God is. Ultimately, it's to bring Nebuchadnezzar to repentance. Spoiler alert. That's what these visions are for. Chapters 2 through 4 are all about Nebuchadnezzar. So that's why he did it. Then we get into the dream and the interpretation. So, here's... actually, I'll have somebody else read that. I'll read the interpretation part. Somebody want to read 31 through 35?
You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay, baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces. At the same time, it became like chaff on the threshing room floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace, but the rock then struck the statue. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth.
All right. Let's make sure we're very clear on this vision, what actually happened. So, first of all, a large and, ESV says, frightening statue. I think you said awesome, right?
Awesome in appearance.
Awesome in appearance, dazzling, frightening, big, spectacular, you might say.
Extraordinary.
Fucking huge.
Extraordinary
huge.
Splendor.
Huge.
It was huge.
Huge.
It was the
huge
best statue.
It's a tremendous statue.
That's nobody makes the statues like the Babylonians. We got different types of metal in different sections. So somebody break them down for me.
Head of gold.
Head of gold.
Bronze.
Chest and arms of silver.
Chest and arms of silver.
Belly and thighs of bronze.
Belly and thighs of bronze. What do you guys have as translations for belly and thighs?
Middle and thighs.
Middle and thighs.
Stomach and thighs.
Stomach and thighs.
Stomach.
Belly and thighs.
And thighs. You all have thighs? That's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do have faith. Thank you very much.
Even though the thighs on this picture aren't of bronze.
Yeah. Because the word thigh, I did a little word study. It's not the whole thigh. The word thigh in this context refers to either the backside, your rump, or shall I say this? Yeah. One's derriere. Or to just the area that would be covered by your armor right here, and you know your bits.
The special part.
That'd be your thigh, one or the other, and then middle, this section, the part that you're trying to always decrease in size and never successful. Middle and thighs of bronze and
legs of iron.
Legs of iron.
And feet of iron and clay.
Feet of iron and clay. You said baked clay, right? That's a nice, it brought through a little bit of translation there. I went with pottery. Clay.
Fired clay.
Fired clay. The point is that clay, when it's hardened, is what?
Glass.
Well, I was going for fragile. But
brittle.
Breakable. Yeah, brittle. Not the strongest stuff in the world. So we all know our basic precious metals, right? Mm-hmm. Gold's the most valuable, silver's the second, bronze is the third, iron's the least, clay is dirt.
Weird system.
Yeah. That's just how it's always been. And that's how it was back then. So we got these five different sections: head, chest, middle and thighs, legs, and feet. And then what happens to this section? A rock. What kind of a rock? How does the text describe it?
A stone was cut out, but not by human hands.
Yeah, a stone cut not with human hands. I'm going to have a different translation there for that description.
Mine says, a stone broke off without a hand touching it.
Broke off without a hand touching it. And it kind of brings to question, broke off from what? Later in the interpretation, we see broke off from the crag or the mountain. But the point is, humans didn't cause this thing to break off. Humans didn't make this rock, like this statue. That's the emphasis. So the rock hits it. Where does it hit it?
On the feet.
In the feet. And what happens after it hits it in the feet?
The whole thing crumbles.
Whole thing crumbles, becomes like chaff in the summer threshing floor. You guys remember what the threshing floor is, right? Think back to Ruth when we watched that little video.
Pitchfork, roll up the wheat or whatever.
Yeah.
And all the chaff floats down.
The chaff blows away.
That one.
Yeah. And then the
wheat stays.
The wheat stays, yeah. So the wheat's heavy, chaff is light. So you thresh it, so you got all the seeds and the grass all mixed up together. You get the pitchfork, you toss it up in the air, the chaff blows away in the breeze, and then the wheat falls back to the ground. You gather it, and you make it into cakes and stuff. Yeah. So that's how this statue blew away, like chaff in the summer breeze. Carried them away so that not a trace could be found. But the stone, what happened to it?
Became a giant mountain.
Became a giant mountain. And did what?
Covered the whole earth.
It's, I imagine, what is Nebuchadnezzar actually seeing that you would describe it as the mountain covering the whole earth? I just get like this cartoon of like zooming out, and then you see
like
the globe. Exactly.
Like the world's turning. It's a mountain.
Yeah. Kind of how I picture it. I doubt that that's what it really looked like. But anyway, everybody clear on what the vision was? I want to make sure we know exactly what it says happened, and then we get Daniel's interpretation. And I want to be very, very clear on what Daniel says the dream means, because we in the 21st century have a little bit more information to help us understand his interpretation. However, sometimes we can go a little bit overboard with helping Daniel along with the interpretation. So I want to be really clear on what Daniel actually said and fill in the gaps where appropriate. So, first, we're just going to go through this section and look at what did Daniel actually say the interpretation was. Verse 36, this was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, listen to this phrase, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all things. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it. Just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay, and as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage. Literally, mixed with one another by the seed of men. But they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure. All right. Go bit by bit, way back up at the top, verse 36. First of all, you guys recognize some phrases in there from being a 21st century Christian? Anything jump out at you from verse 37?
King of Kings.
Mm-hmm. King of Kings? Who do we generally ascribe that title to?
God.
What about the other phrase? To whom the God has given the
kingdom, power.
Yeah, where's that from?
Forever,
oh, yeah. Okay, there we go.
Yeah, the end of the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6:13.
Mine says, given dominion and power.
Given dominion. Yeah, and anyway, there's that also shows up in the Psalms. Psalm 45:11, to be exact. We'll look that up in a little bit. But what's he done? What has the God of heaven given to this King of Kings?
The kingdom to rule.
Yeah. And in particular, everything.
Every single thing.
Right? Wherever anyone dwells, beasts of the field, birds of the heavens, sky, making you rule over them all. And then what does he say to him?
The head of gold.
You are the head of gold. All right, so we have our first identification. Head of gold equals who?
Nebuchadnezzar. I think it's Nebuchadnezzar. Am I right?
Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar.
There you go.
You are the head of gold. But then what's going to happen?
Another kingdom is going to come?
Another kingdom of what sort compared to Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom?
Inferior.
Will arise. And then very quickly, he moves on to a third kingdom. How does he describe his third kingdom?
It will rule all over the earth.
Yeah. Kingdom of bronze, and it will rule all over the earth. Okay. So we're taking notes about it. So head of gold is Nebuchadnezzar. That one's locked in. The second kingdom will be slightly inferior to Babylon. Bronze Kingdom will rule all over the earth. All right. We've gotten through the easy parts. Verse 40. There shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron. And why is he using the description of iron?
Who knows?
Just read the rest of verse 40.
It smashes.
Because it smashes, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. It's smashing, powerful, yeah. Oh, you don't have to. Smashing to pieces. This is the fourth kingdom, strong as iron. And like iron that crushes, it shall do what?
Crush and smash all the others.
All the others, yeah. ESV said specifically, crush all these. Does anybody else have a different translation for the very end of verse 40? What's it going to smash?
Break into pieces and crush the others.
The others?
Mm-hmm.
The others.
Yeah, the others is definitely the best contextual translation. That it's actually not as definite in the original language, but it's clear from context. What he's saying is it's going to defeat all the other nations that have come before. So the bronze, the silver, the head of gold, anything that's left of them, it's going to crush them. And then verse 41, I want you to take note of the starting phrase. ESV says, and as you saw the feet, what are the first few words for all the rest of you in verse 41?
In that you were seeing feet and toes.
In that you were seeing feet. Anybody else?
Just as you saw.
In that you saw.
In that you saw, just as you saw.
Just as mine starts with you saw.
You saw. That's a... There's a little bit of a shift in the...
Whereas I have sauced.
Cadence of the Aramaic there. He's been starting out lots of these phrases with and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And then he switches. So we're going to talk a little bit about that switch when we get to our interpretation. But just take note of the beginning of verse 41. Okay, and as he's looking at these feet, what does he see?
Clay and iron mixed.
Clay and iron mixed. And so what does that indicate about this fifth kingdom?
It's divided.
It's divided.
But mixed.
But mixed. So some strength of iron, ESV says firmness of iron, shall be in it. Does anybody else have a different translation for that? The firmness of iron?
Mm-hmm.
Strength of iron.
Yeah.
Does anybody have toughness?
In which place?
Verse 41. Second half.
Toughness.
The toughness. That's
yes.
It. Yeah. So the quality of the iron in this mix is its strength, its power, right? Crushing ability. But then what's the quality of the clay?
Brittle.
Brittle, yeah.
Soft.
So they mix together in this divided kingdom. How do they mix together?
Not very well.
Not very well. What does verse 43 say is going to happen?
They'll mix, but they won't hold.
They mix, but they won't hold. And then how are they mixing in human terms?
They don't.
Merge.
Yeah, so ESV renders it marriage. The NIV render it marriage there.
Don't even mention marriage.
Yeah, what is yours?
You saw the iron mixed with the baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay.
Oh, wow, that got really interpretive there. So the people will be a mixture.
Hmm.
That's so the most literal kind of choppy version would be that the people will... or so that they... They is unclear who the they is. They will mix with one another by the seed of men. So, question to ask yourself is who is the they? Is they the kings of this divided kingdom? Is they the two kingdoms themselves? Is they the inhabitants of this divided kingdom mixing with each other in the inhabitants? Something to consider. But they, again, will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. So, who is the they? Interpretive question to answer. So NIV just kind of did a little bit of interpreting for you. They're going to say, it's the people living in the kingdom. And ESV does a little bit of that too by saying, oh, they did it in marriage, so probably talking about the inhabitants, the citizens of this divided kingdom. And in the days of those kings, so this is verse 44, the reference changes. In the days of those kings, well, where did those kings come from? This is the first time we've referenced specific kings, right? Which makes me think that the they of verse 44, verse 43 is actually the kings, but I'm getting ahead of myself. They combine, they will not hold together. We've got multiple kings in verse 44. Days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will what?
Not be destroyed, will not be left to another people.
Never be destroyed, never change hands. Alright. And it's going to break to pieces all of these other kingdoms. Bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, just as you saw this stone cut, turned into a mountain, stood forever. And the stone that's not cut by human hands, implication is that this is God's doing, right? Not man's doing. So, everybody clear on what occurred, how Daniel interpreted the dream? Right. We're going to walk through and fill in some of the gaps, because we've lived past this point in history. We've seen these events take place. So we can pretty clearly see where some of these things have been fulfilled already as you trek through history. Interpretation. Gold head is Babylon. That one's easy, because Daniel straight up says, Nebuchadnezzar, you're the gold head. That one's done. But another empire will come up after you. Slightly inferior. Medo-Persians. We actually have a scriptural record of that, and we'll cover it in Daniel, but end of chapter 5 is the fall of Babylon to the Medo-Persians. You go to chapter 5, verse 30. That very night, Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's son, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. We see Darius the Mede ruling for a little bit, and then we see Cyrus, king of Persia, come along. So, the Bible actually records that section of the history. Medo-Persians come along. What are some of the things that the Medo-Persians did? We've studied Ezra and Nehemiah. We know this. What does King Cyrus do?
He lets him go back.
Yeah.
And build a wall.
Yeah. He lets him go back and rebuild the temple, and then King Xerxes lets him go back and build the wall. Nice. Excuse me, Artaxerxes.
Excuse me?
And actually, yes, Persia did pay for it. Surprises me that so many people are doing Daniel right now when they should be doing Nehemiah. But anyway. What followed Persia? Who came along and spoiled Persia's party?
I want to say Greece.
Greece.
But I'm not sure.
In the multiple places where it says it. Yeah. Iron it out.
Who specifically came along? Leading Greece.
Right?
Yeah, that guy.
Alexander the Great, right? Alexander the Great has this big beef with Persia because they went and beat up on Macedonia one too many times. Mm-hmm. And he says, enough of this. And he just marches through and takes over all of Persia.
You don't do that no more.
Remember the phrase that describes the...
That, like, turtle method?
Yes. Nice. The phalanx system. The description we had for this bronze nation, Greece, what was it?
Wait, say again?
What was the description from
will rule over all the earth.
It will rule over all the earth, right? That's kind of what Alexander the Great's commonly, colloquially known for, right? as Hans Gruber says in Die Hard, quoting someone who he's not, Plutarch didn't actually say it, but it's the first time it was ever said was in Die Hard. So. And Alexander saw that all that he had conquered and wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. Alexander looked over the breadth of his domain and wept that there were no more worlds to conquer. It is commonly expressed, though, before Die Hard, that Alexander conquered the known world. That's his claim to fame, right? Mm-hmm. He would rule over all the earth. We're going to see a very, very specific prophecy about Alexander the Great when we get to chapter 6, 7.
And later in the story.
Yeah. He just, like, outright, like...
Spoiler.
Alexander the Great, it, like, literally just almost names him. It doesn't actually name him, but it practically does. And there's a famous story of when Alexander the Great got to Israel, of why he let the Jews be when he was doing this.
Because
they had the prophecy about him. Because they essentially just brought him the book of Daniel and said, look, we knew you were coming. And Alexander the Great was like, you're right, this is about me. Okay, I'll let you live. And he moves on.
Appeal to his vanity.
Fun stuff. But we'll get there.
You mean provided for the people of Israel?
Yeah.
What?
Crazy.
Who'd have thunk it?
Then we got the thighs of iron. Thighs are bronze. Possible reference to Alexander the Great's four successors. This was my own little thought, but the thighs are the quadriceps. How many muscles are in the quadriceps?
Oh, boy.
Four. Alexander had four successors. The Ptolemies, Seleucids. No? Too much?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've studied Greece history and stuff, and physical.
Greece does specifically break into four, and we're going to see that in a later prophecy. I just thought it was interesting.
It's a good point, though.
Yeah, it's not real. Don't go propagating that one. That goes under the reading
thigh.
Too much into it category.
It definitely does.
Yeah. But you know I did my homework, though, right? I was thinking about this. Iron legs. What's their description again?
Smash
everything. This is what Rome is known for.
Rome smash.
Rome smashes. Rome's military power is legendary and needs no explanation. Rome smashed and conquered all of Greece, and they smashed and conquered all of what was left of Persia. And they did their thing. They are obviously the legs of iron. That's most interpreters agree with those four. When we get to the feet is where lots of interpreters start to diverge. What is this nation that's part iron, part clay? How should we go about interpreting this? So, what I'm about to give you is what's called the futurist interpretation. It is the interpretation that I hold to. I'll briefly cover the others after I'm done giving you this one, if I have time. But I'm going to make a case for it, because it makes the most sense, as far as I can tell. So here it is. The feat of part iron and part clay is a yet future kingdom. Hasn't occurred yet. For us in the 21st century, like, we're looking forward to a kingdom that's going to come along and be this part iron, part clay nation. How do you get there? All of these others were immediately successive, right? Well, first of all, history throws us a little bit of a loop. So, going to jump ahead a little bit. We're going to guess the rock is who?
Jesus,
right? He's establishing the kingdom of God, right?
Dwayne.
Oh, I don't even want to think about that. So yeah, spoiler alert: the rock is Jesus. But if the rock is Jesus' first coming, then the feat of part iron and part clay had to have been Rome in 1st century A.D. Problem is, Rome was at pretty much the height of its power in 1st century A.D. It was starting to wane a little bit, but there's no kind of clear understanding of how the 1st century A.D. Rome is this part iron, part clay, with multiple kings mixed thing. So, whatever however you go about that, that throws a little bit of a kink in the works. Rome doesn't fall until the late 200s. Rome doesn't even split into two nations, East and West, until the late 200s. Eastern Rome, AD.
Okay.
Eastern Rome didn't fall to the Ottomans until 1453, which would be the area that we're talking about with Babylon. The Ottoman Empire comes in and takes them over. So, the idea that this rock smashing the feet of part iron, part clay means that the nation had to be around when the rock did that. But the rock hasn't done that. Unless we're going to mess with the interpretation a little bit and say, okay, let's spiritualize this part. I don't like doing that. So I'm saying that the feet of part iron, part clay is a yet future nation, and we can tell a few things probably about it. First of all, likely it will have 10 rulers. You get that from Daniel 7, which is a later prophecy we'll get to that kind of informs this. It's talking about the exact same series of kingdoms with a second vision. So that's something a little bit for future study. But the 10 horns in Daniel 7 make it very clear that there's 10 kings in this part iron, part clay kingdom. And then the fact that there's 10 toes in the statue, the feet of part iron, part clay, also seems to suggest 10 rulers. And that would be the multiple kings mentioned in verse 44. Why future? No known kingdom in history fits the 10-king conglomerate as nicely as the previous kingdoms fit their historical fulfillments. As we saw, all those other four were just like kind of spot on. Slipped right into place. Second, is the other thing we can tell about what it'll probably be is be something like Rome. Either it'll come out of Rome, or it will have a very Rome-esque quality. Some have suggested maybe it'll be like a government system like Rome. It'll have a Senate, a republic.
Globalism.
A little bit like that. I was thinking more a republic, but that too. Like say the Republic of Iran, Republic of Iraq, something like that. Or people will suggest it's actually going to come out of Rome, so they'll look to the Roman Catholic Church, the Vatican. Lots of people try to pin.
Because Rome is iron, and it's iron and clay, which makes sense that would be a Roman fist.
Exactly, the continuation of the iron in the description. What's the justification for putting this huge gap of time in the prophecy, though, right? Because in this statue, they're all connected, and they're all successive until what I'm suggesting is you get to the ankles, and then there's 2,000 years plus of history that isn't mentioned. The linguistic justification for it was that little phrase that I pointed out to you at the beginning of verse 41, in that you saw. Is my translation of it. And I gave you there's a double conjunctive wa di instead of the simple vav conjunctive wa. He adds an extra word to let you know. And then that thing that you saw. He switches his pattern of how he's been giving this interpretation. So there's a little bit of a linguistic switch when he gets to the feet of part iron, part clay. That's the only linguistic justification from within this exact interpretation of why I would say you're allowed to put in that gap of time there. The other thing is we see that quite often in prophecies. Prophets will talk about Christ's first coming and second coming very clearly in one paragraph or one sentence and not distinguish the two. But we from history know, the first half of that was fulfilled in his first coming, and we look forward to his fulfilling that in his second coming. And that's just how prophets did it. So it's not completely unheard of for a prophecy to have a gap of time that they don't mention specifically. There's just some slight linguistic cue to let you know there's a gap of time there. We've talked about that before in this group, So that is why I hold to a futurist interpretation. I think I covered some of the other basic interpretations. Some of the others are that the first three are actually work through with me. Babylon, then the Medes is the silver chest, the Persians is the bronze, and then Greece is the iron, legs of iron, and then Rome is the feet of part iron and part clay. They don't even say that Rome is the feet of part iron and part clay. They'll say that the broken up Grecian empire, the four successors of Alexander the Great, are the feet of part iron and part clay, and it's in that that the rock comes. That's a common Roman Catholic interpretation. There's another interpretation that says that the feet of part iron, part clay is during the Renaissance and Reformation period. So some Calvinists like to say that the Reformation was the rock coming in and establishing the kingdom. Yeah, post-millennial, so throw that one around. Whatever you do, you got a little bit of problem with the history, so you gotta figure out where the switch is. And I think that the linguistic justification and the logical justification of we're waiting for the kingdom to be established right now. So this feeds into, as you guys have heard me rant as we went through Luke, the fact that I don't think we're living in the kingdom right now. The kingdom of God is yet to be established. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. How am I doing on time? We got 15 minutes. All right, good. Before we get to that, I want to talk about this rock. First of all, we've already established that it's Jesus, right? I want to hammer home that point in just a minute. The God of heaven will establish a kingdom which will never be destroyed, will crush and end all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. What are these kingdoms in verse 44? What do you think? Have I bored you all to death talking through different interpretations?
Mm-mm. I mean, it destroyed all of them. Broke up everything.
Yeah, okay. So
not just the feet. Although it hit the feet, it broke everything up.
Good, yeah. It's all of the previous kingdoms that were mentioned in the statue. Say verse 45 suggested. The following verse says, you saw that the stone was cut from human hands, or broken pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold. Okay, so we're talking about those five kingdoms. Which, again, with the futurist interpretation, would make sense, because Jesus would come back the second time, finishing off the feet. He came back, it came in the first time, and began to finish off, you might say, the first four. But I don't actually go that way, because that's an already not yet version of saying that the kingdom's already been established, which I don't agree with. There you have it. That's one that progressive dispensationalists will throw out there. What about this kingdom? How is it described?
Endure forever.
It will endure forever. Stand forever. It's eternal. This is an extremely common theme in the Bible and in the prophets. Let's go read Psalm 145 together. So this is where you're going to be flipping a lot. So get your fingers ready. Psalm 145, verses 8 through 14. Read this and tell me if you think this sounds like everything we've been talking about.
Which one?
Psalm 145, verses 8 through 14. The Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all, and his mercy is over all that he has made. All your works shall give thanks to you, O Lord, and all your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of the glory of your kingdom and tell of your power. Thine is the kingdom and the glory and the power. To make known the children of man your mighty deeds, to make known to the children of man your mighty deeds and the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Your dominion endures throughout all generations. Who's talking there?
David.
David, yeah. He's talking about God's kingdom that's going to come and it's going to be forever. Ezekiel 37 verse 25, describes the kingdom that's going to be given to the nation of Israel. This is the interpretation of the Valley of the Dry Bones. My servant David shall be king over them. They shall have all one shepherd. They shall walk in my rules and be careful to obey my statutes. They shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children's children shall dwell there forever. And David, my servant, shall be their prince forever. This is after David has died. So, who is he talking about? How David's going to rule on the throne? You guys remember one of Jesus' names? What does Bartimaeus, the blind beggar at Jericho, call out to him?
Son of David.
Son of David. We're looking for descendant of David to sit on the throne forever and ever. Amos 9:11 does the same thing. Quite a few of the minor prophets talk about the establishment of the remnant in the land of Israel, giving them the kingdom. Verse 11, in that day I will raise up the booth of David that is fallen, and repair its breaches, raise up its ruins, rebuild it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the nations that are called by my name, declares the Lord who does this. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, treader of grapes, him who sows the seeds, the mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel. They shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They will plant vineyards, drink their wine, they shall make a garden, eat their fruit. I will plant them on their land. They shall never again be uprooted out of the land that I have given them. These are the promises that God is making to Israel again and again. What's the promise? You're going to get a kingdom. It's going to be amazing, and it will never be taken away from you. We get into the New Testament when Jesus actually shows up the first time. Mm-hmm. You guys know what's happening in Luke 1, right? Because mm-hmm. we did Luke.
Oh, so long ago.
Luke 1, 32. This is when Angel Gabriel is appearing to Mary, telling her about her son. He will be great, will be called Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give to him the throne of his father, David. He will reign over the house of Jacob. How long?
Forever.
And of his kingdom, there will be no end. All right.
Heard that before.
So the eternal quality of the kingdom is quite important all throughout the history of Israel. The fact that when Jesus establishes the kingdom, it ain't going away. So, if you hold to the view that says that we are living in the kingdom in some sense now, you are also holding to the view that it is not going to diminish or extinguish between now and the second coming.
There will be no nuclear holocaust.
Yeah. Hey, why are you guys packing up? We've got another 10 minutes. Come on. There's a backside to this.
You're that teacher. We're not done yet.
We're not to the exciting part. This is where. So the rock. This is what I wanted to do.
I do.
The stone that was cut from a crag without human hands. Okay. The stone is Jesus. Guys, if you ever have time to sit down and do a Bible word search of stone or rock in the Bible, you will be fascinated to see all of these occurrences. So I pulled up. I did that today.
I'm sorry, I see. Wow.
And I referenced, these are just the times when I am confident that stone is a metaphor for the triune God in some sense, and often for Jesus himself. These are just the times that I'm confident of that. But we're only going to look at the ones that I bolded, because we don't have time to read all of these, unfortunately. Exodus 20. Verse 25. You guys know what's going on in Exodus 20? It's one of those chapters that you need to, like, just kind of have in your head. You should flip over to Exodus 20. It'll clue you in. You'll see it in a heading.
The Ten Commandments.
It's the giving of the law. Jesus, God, the triune God, is giving Moses the Mosaic law. Right? So he's give him the Ten Commandments, and he starts talking about the laws about altars. Verse 25 says, If you make an altar of stone, you shall not build it out of hewn stones, for if you wield a tool on it, you profane it. Okay, did that click in for you? All right. A stone not cut by human hands is the stone that they build the altar to provide propitiation for sins on for Israel. Ringing any bells? Okay. That's something that's always been in my mind. Why are they not allowed to cut stones? Like, that's just weird. Like, Moses is receiving this law. It's like, everybody shapes their stones to build their altars. We're not allowed to do that. We have to find stones that fit. The reason is because it's a typography of Jesus.
What?
Stone not cut with human hands. Deuteronomy 32. This is like a summary of the Bible in one chapter. This is like the whole story. It's Deuteronomy chapter 32. But in particular, verses 3 and 4, this is Moses singing a song to the nation of Israel. It's like, kind of like his last words. And he's prophesying essentially their entire future and the coming of the Messiah. Pretty spectacular. He starts singing verse 3. He says, "For I will proclaim the name of the Lord God and ascribe greatness to our God, the Rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice, a God of faithfulness without iniquity." So who's the Rock?
I don't know.
More specifically, who is the Rock in this context? "For I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God, the Rock. His work is perfect." It's not necessarily Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, but God, the triune God. He's the Rock. The Rock shows up all throughout this song.
It says, "As for the Rock."
And it has "for the Rock." We get more narrow, right? We start clarifying the context. So yeah, 15 through 18 is an important section. Flip over to 36 through 43, though. "For the Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants. When he sees that their power is gone, there is none remaining bond or free, then he will say, 'Where are their gods, the rock in which they took refuge, the fake gods, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offerings? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protection. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and swear, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on my judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversaries. I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh, the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired heads of the enemy. Rejoice with him, O heavens. Bow down to him, all gods, for he avenges the blood of his children and takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's lands. This is the rock that crushes all the other kingdoms into nothing, and they blow away like chaff in the wind." Right? All through the Psalms. I just wrote the chapter numbers because there were too many to do. But a common phrase in the Psalms is "the rock of my salvation." You guys have heard that phrase? Jesus, the rock of my salvation. Psalm 118. 22. "The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." The New Testament authors quote this all the time. And in case you weren't sure, if the rock is Jesus, also the rock that, so the rock that Moses strikes, remember he's, the first time he goes up and he hits it and the water comes out, and the second time he goes and he strikes it twice even though he wasn't supposed to, but the water still comes out, that rock is Jesus too. I know, you're thinking, that's crazy, Stephen. Where did you get these stupid allegorical interpretations? Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers." This is Paul writing to the Corinthians. "I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses and the cloud and in that sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. They drank from the rock that followed them, drank the water from the rock that Moses hit. And the rock was Christ. 1 Peter 2. So you getting this picture yet? And you guys have heard all the times in the Gospels when the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. And this is Jesus.
First I think some hymns talk about it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you, 1 Peter 2, Peter's talking to the diaspora, the Jews spread all throughout who are believers. As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it stands in the scriptures, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone, chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. Who's the stone? Jesus. So the honor is for you who believe. But for those who do not believe, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Still the same rock, and they stumble over it. Same rock as Jesus. They stumble because they disobeyed the word as they were destined to, as we see in Daniel. They are destined to. But I digress. This is one unified story. I don't know how I can say it any other ways. It's the same story all through. This.
What was that? Say that again.
It's the same story.
Did you say the same
or different story? It's one unified story.
What'd you learn from that when I was studying? Well, I think it's something to do with a unified story.
Don't quote me.
We're going to skip over that question I had. So, has the kingdom been established or not? I got 1 minute left to make this case. I think not. I think it was legitimately offered in Christ's first coming and literally rejected by Israel and will be established at Christ's second coming. So are we living in the kingdom now? I think no. The kind of the hammer home verse for that is the end of Matthew. Chapter 24, verse 34. This is one of the last times, if not the last time. I put 24, 34. It should say 25, 34 on your notes. One of the last times that the kingdom is mentioned. He's prophesying about the final judgment. If you know, chapters 24 and 25 of Matthew are end times prophecy. Jesus is talking. He says, "Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom promised for you from the foundation of the world.'" Since we're talking about the end times, and God is saying to these people, come and inherit the kingdom, it stands to reason for me that they didn't have it before then. So, ergo, we're not living in the kingdom right now. We will in the future, in the resurrection. What is the kingdom? Well, go read Revelation 19 through 21 and 22 to learn about that. We'll end there, because the rest of the story is really straightforward and easy. What happens? Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face, paid homage to Daniel. Notice he paid homage to Daniel. Still doesn't quite get it. Takes two more chapters before he really understands. Your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords. He does not use the definite article, the God of gods. Mm. Even though some translations render it that way. Promise you the definite article is not there. And then Daniel makes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego some administrators in the province of Babylon while he stays in the king's court. So they're out doing their thing, and the story switches to them in the next chapter. So, we will do all of chapter 3 next week. It is the famous fiery furnace story.
Oh, boy. Face black opening.
Is there significance between the similarity of the material and the legs with the material and the feet?
Yeah, I think that the future kingdom will be related to Rome in some way, either in spirit, the crushing sort of all-powerful sort of spirit, or it will actually come out of Italy. That's I'm adding quite a bit to that interpretation. Like, if I have to take a guess, for anything it'll be. But I think the safest, clearest interpretation from the text is definitely it'll have the toughness thing, and that's why he describes the toughness of iron will be mixed with the
just thinking that the material carries into the feet.
Yeah.
It's not fun anymore. Just real quick, I know you're talking about like the linguistic part of it, where in the interpretation how it goes from like flowing into each kingdom and then there's like a break.
Yeah.
In this Holman Bible, I don't know why I didn't see it before, but definitely like verses 41 through 43 all start as you saw, you saw, you saw. Like, he just keeps repeating that phrase. Like, it's not in the same verses, because it says there will be another kingdom, and then a fourth kingdom, and then another kingdom. It's just like, you saw this. And then it switches into, you saw the feet and toes.
Good observation.
You saw the iron mixed with clay. You saw the iron mixed with clay again. So it does make it, it's not like flowing into the next.
Yeah, it doesn't
section.
Follow the same rhythm as the previous ones did.
No, it's more like, there's like a divide between those four kingdoms and then this last part. I've never heard of that Bible translation, but I actually like it a lot.
Some people will say that they'll pick out different Roman emperors and say there's 10 of them. And so that's how they get the iron and clay. And then they'll say, I haven't actually read anybody, but I would guess that people who go with that will also talk about the split of East and Western Rome to be the iron and the clay sort of thing. Honestly, I read 7 or 8 of those other different interpretations. None of them have any kind of consistency.
There's no common denominator?
It really isn't. For any of you, really. Even the dispensationalists, the people I agree with, they'll still read a whole lot into it and start making calls about who's in what
Amazon,
and
it's like
where the kingdom is. Yeah, all right.
So, you want one.
All I'm confident in saying is I do think it is a future kingdom, yeah. And we're living in the in between the legs and the feet.
We're living in the ankles.
Yeah, we're living in the ankles right now. I feel like there's a Joel Osteen book in there somewhere.
We're in the metatarsals right now.
Live life in Nebuchadnezzar's ankles.